U.S. Supreme Court ruling went in favor of President Trump and his executive order regarding birthright citizenship. That Supreme Court ruling came down on Friday. I was off the air on Friday here on The Morning Ride, but since I'm back here on Monday, I want to try and figure out some of what all this is going to mean, because the U.S. Supreme Court declined to decide the constitutionality of birthright citizenship itself. So that's going to be a court hearing for another date and time. Joining me here on The Morning Ride on Talk Radio 570 KVI is Center for Immigration Studies Fellow, Resident Fellow in Law and Policy, Andrew Art Arthur. Art, thanks for coming on the show this morning. It's good to have you back on KVI in Seattle.
Thanks so much for having me today, Phil.
Yeah, just to give everybody a little insight for Art's experience. He's worked in Washington, D.C., National Security Subcommittee, House of Representatives. He, in 2006, served as an immigration judge in York, Pennsylvania, heard thousands of deportation, removal, exclusion, bond cases, and considered applications for asylum and other forms of immigration-related relief. So that's some of his background on this. And with your law background, after this Supreme Court ruling, the big part of this ruling from last Friday is that it deals with nationwide injunctions. And these have applied to a couple of Trump executive orders that have been brought into court. So tell us what's going to happen as a result of this Supreme Court ruling and the nationwide injunctions.
Sure. And just by way of background, Phil, nationwide injunctions are issued by one judge, one district court judge, and one district somewhere in the United States. And it purports to bind the federal government to a certain course of action or prevent them from doing a certain thing everywhere else in the United States. A lot of these cases are brought in the District of Washington, the District of Maryland, the District of Columbia, traditionally more liberal jurisdictions. And when those judges issue those decisions, the government basically can't do anything with respect to the question until a higher court rules on it, in this case, a court of appeals or the Supreme Court. What Friday's decision did was it said there's no justification anywhere in Anglo-American law, and they went back to the Revolution and went forward to find that any district court judge has any authority to issue a nationwide jurisdiction to basically bind the entire executive branch to an opinion brought by one judge. It's also important to keep in mind when you're talking about a circuit court decision, generally they have three judge panels and two of those judges have to agree. When you're talking about the Supreme Court, as we all know, there are nine justices and five of them have to agree before they take any action. Only in our legal system, and again, only up until Friday, could one independent judge simply bind the entire government based upon his or her own opinion. So that is done for the time being. People are going to be able to seek nationwide injunctions in federal court. They're going to have to either go the class action route and bring together a large number of people, or they're just going to have to do these cases individually.
So when you say the class action route, that means finding individuals that would be impacted by this, that they would have to have standing, and that would all have to get sorted out as well. It wouldn't be just you could have, let's just throw out an arbitrary number, you couldn't have just 40 states attorneys general that walk in and go, hey, this is our class action of 40 states. That wouldn't apply, correct?
Yeah, no, it wouldn't apply in that situation. And the rules still for class action lawsuits are actually pretty rigorous. They're set forth in Rule 23 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, and judges have to tick through a whole bunch of requirements before they can certify that class. So really the next case that's going to come before the Supreme Court on these issues is going to be one that, you know, narrowly defines who is in a class and who has standing.
There you go. I watched Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul. I know about class action lawsuits now. I got my law degree on television watching TV shows. Art, so the constitutionality of birthright citizenship itself is not decided in this case that went through, was finalized by the Supreme Court last Friday. But that's the big question. What does the Trump executive order seek to pursue as it relates to birthright citizenship?
So Under the 14th Amendment, any person born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof is a citizen of the United States and of the state in which they reside. You probably heard that phrase, a dozen times since Trump first took his action. What he's attempting to do is to limit the birthright citizenship of children who were born to aliens unlawfully present in the United States, particularly if both parents are here unlawfully or if one is here unlawfully and the other only has temporary status. So that is what Trump is attempting to do. And it's important to note, Phil, that Friday's decision was never going to touch on birthright citizenship because, again, the only real issue before the court, as framed by the Department of Justice, was whether nationwide jurisdictions are valid or not.
Right.
The problem with the district court's decision in CASA versus Trump, which was the main case that was at issue, there was Trump versus New Jersey and Trump versus Washington as well, was that it prevented the executive branch from even rolling out guidance on how this would be implemented, what would happen. CASA versus Trump was filed the day after Trump issued Executive Order 14160, which is his birthright pronouncement. So because it prevented the government from moving forward, it in essence blocked the Justice Department, DHS, the State Department, from taking any action until the case was resolved. Now at least it can go through those preliminary steps, and you're going to get a whole lot of law experts, a lot of professors, a lot of organizations who are going to give their thoughts to the courts, on how expansive or narrow the 14th Amendment is. And that's the way that our judicial system is supposed to work. The courts are supposed to be well-informed, and on this rather portentous decision, they need to get as much advice as they can so they make the right decision.
Yeah. Can you lay out a strong argument one way or the other for limiting birthright citizenship if the parent of a child is not in the United States legally?
Absolutely. So the 14th Amendment actually built on an earlier piece of legislation, the Civil Rights Act of 1866. And the Civil Rights Act of 1866 was intended to reverse the Dred Scott case. We all, when we went to school, we learned about Dred Scott. Mm-hmm. It was an enslaved person in Missouri, and he went to Illinois. And, he claimed as soon as he got to Illinois, he was free. And Chief Justice Roger Taney, in an 1850s decision, said no slave or child of a slave is a citizen of the United States and never will be. Well, that was just judicial activism and on steroids. And so Congress stepped in and passed the Civil Rights Act of 1866, which begins, all persons born in the United States and not subject to any foreign power are citizens of the United States. There's no indication that the 14th Amendment intended to broaden that language in the Civil Rights Act of 1866. And the only reason that the 14th Amendment was ever passed was because the Republicans who ran Congress were concerned the Democrats were going to take power and reverse the Civil Rights Act of 1866. Once you put it in the Constitution, that becomes a whole lot more difficult. So when you go back to the base language of this, plainly, any person who is, not completely subject to the United States, those are the only people who, can be the parents of U.S. citizens. Now, there's strong arguments running in the other direction. Judge Jim Ho of the Fifth Circuit, who is probably going to be on the Supreme Court within the next few years, has a lot of arguments to go the other way. So really, this all plays out in the courts, but it is one of those things that needs to be resolved. You think about it, Phil. If I drive from Oregon into Washington as a commercial trucker, I know exactly how much air I need to have in my tires to drive on those Washington state roads. I can't tell you dispositively who is a citizen and who is not. The case law is just not clear on that. And it's a very important decision because it decides who can be president of the United States, what public benefits you receive, whether you can vote or not. I mean, this is an important issue in one way or the other. It needs to be dispositively decided by the Supreme Court.
Do you think any ruling, when this ultimately comes back to, this is ultimately going to end up in the U.S. Supreme Court, I think we'd all be naive to think otherwise, as it relates to who is lawfully in the United States, do you think that ends up having application to things like who gets to vote in the United States and who gets Medicaid benefits or those types of federally related benefits?
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah, I mean, it's going to govern all of that. Wow. You know, when you are a United States citizen, you're born a United States citizen, you never think about all of the benefits that it carries with you. But, you know, if you go abroad and something bad happens to you, the FBI will fly into action to figure out what happened and to get you out of trouble and use the military if they need to. All of those things, not just simply who gets Medicaid. I mean, that passport that you carry is a powerful tool and, you know, opens doors to countries all around the world.
Final question. I wasn't sure. Did you notice or pick up on what was in the majority opinion by Amy Coney Barrett and the things that she was pointing out about the dissenting opinion by Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson and that back and forth? Did you? Or,
oh, yes. Yeah. So, I took special notice of that.
Yeah, a lot of legal observers looked into that and Amy Coney Barrett's criticism of the dissenting opinion by Ketanji Brown Jackson. Can you sum it up for listeners that maybe hadn't seen it or kind of summarize it a little bit?
Absolutely. So Justice Jackson's opinion was that somebody needs to be needs to hold the executive branch accountable. Mm-hmm. And, you know, regardless of, you know, what statute says or, you know, what happened at the time of the revolution, the judges should have that power regardless to hold the executive branch accountable. You know, that they should. Her words were, you know, we don't need to go into all this legalese.
And I believe that she used a term called an imperial executive, meaning the president, as somebody who's imperial.
That's right. And, you know, to which Justice Barrett, who, keep in mind, taught civil procedure and constitutional law at the University of Notre Dame and is pretty familiar with these concepts, she responded that the response to an imperial executive is not an imperial judiciary.
Right, yeah.
And, you know, if you read Federalist 73, Alexander Hamilton said, the courts are supposed to be the weakest of the three branches in our government. And yet, if you carry forward Justice Brown's philosophy, they become the strongest. They can tell Congress and the executive branch what they can and cannot do. So this is, you know, if you go to law school, you hear about the differing legal philosophies. And what you saw, what you read in that opinion is Barrett, who was a strong originalist who relies on text and law, going up against, critical legal scholar in Ketanji Brown Jackson, who thinks that the law should exist for that the law should be interpreted to do the most good, however an individual judge views that. We're a republic. We're a democratic republic, and our elected officials make those calls. And, you know, in that particular instance, this was the right call, in my opinion.
Yeah. Constitutional Republic. Well, I thank you very much, Art Arthur. This is the first citation of the Federalist 73 on the morning ride since I've been the show host back to April 7th. So it only took us just a little under 3 months to get that Federalist 73 paper citation. Thank you for that. Well, I appreciate your time. Yeah, yeah. Right now, I got to go. I got to spend the afternoon reading the rest of it. But thank you very much, Andrew Art Arthur from Center for Immigration Studies, and he's been a former immigration judge himself. He's got the legal background, the legal knowledge about this to help us decipher what happened with this U.S. Supreme Court ruling and what this is going to mean with the future challenge to birthright citizenship, the 14th Amendment. Thank you very much for all the explanation today, Art.
Thanks so much for having me, Phil. Appreciate
you
it.
Bet. All right. We'll talk again soon, I'm sure. Maybe hopefully before this one gets to the Supreme Court. That would be a long time. But thank you very much, Art.
Of course. Thank you.
All righty. So good explanations there, man. That helped me understand it. I was seeing bits and pieces about this all weekend long and trying to sort some of this stuff out. But that Civil Rights Act of 1866 and the 14th Amendment is where the Trump administration is going to hang its hat on this, that you get to be a citizen of the United States if you're born in this country and you're here legally. So that's going to be the dividing line. If you're not here legally, that's what the Trump administration is going to seek to argue to block birthright citizenship. So there's a little of the distinction. All right.